It's one of the most acclaimed hospitals on the planet, and of course, it includes a branch in Jacksonville. The incredible story of the Mayo Clinic, told by one of the greatest storytellers of our time. Good Thursday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, a special treat as we speak with legendary documentary filmmaker Ken Burns. His latest film, The Mayo Clinic, Faith, Hope, Science, debuts later this month right here on WJCT Television. There's even a screening tonight at UNF, but if you can't make that, guess what? You're in luck. Ken Burns is in studio now and taking your calls, so get on the line at 549-2937. Then later, as Hurricane Florence bears down on the Carolinas, a surprising expression of art, hurricane art at the Kummer Museum. Plus, some exciting news, the return of the Jacksonville Film Festival. We'll tell you about that too later this morning. All of that ahead this hour. But first, it all started in 1981 with a PBS documentary about the construction of the Brooklyn Bridge and its impact on New York. Then his career exploded with the PBS series The Civil War, one of the most highly acclaimed documentary series in television history. Since then, Ken Burns has used his camera lens and talent for storytelling to bring to us the essential tales of our American history, everything from westward expansion and the Dust Bowl to the history of jazz and the Vietnam War. His latest project hits a little closer to home here in our area as Burns tells the story of one of the world's best known and acclaimed hospitals. The Mayo Clinic Faith Hope Science premieres on television Tuesday, September 25th on PBS stations across the country, including WJCT. Here's a clip from the film. Take a listen.
More than 20 people died in the tornado that swept through Rochester that summer day in 1883. And dozens more were injured. The Sisters of St. Francis had done what they could to help. But afterwards, Mother Alfred knew they could have done more. Then she had her vision of building a hospital. A place, she insisted, that would be open to all sick persons, regardless of their color, sex, financial status, or professed religion. Mother Alfred was a 53-year-old nun who believed that the cause of suffering humanity knows no religion. Dr. Mayo was a 64-year-old agnostic who, a newspaperman remembered, defended Darwin by the hour. Both were stubborn and impetuous, driven by a desire to serve. Mayo was certain Mother Alfred would be unable to raise the money. She could buy the land she wanted just west of town for $2,000, but the building would cost at least $40,000. But if she did succeed, he reluctantly agreed to lead its medical staff and perform all his surgeries there, while still running his practice downtown.
He thought, there's no way they're going to raise $40,000. And she was convinced, she knew the sisters would raise that money. And she would hold him to that.
The Mayo Clinic Faith, Hope, Science premieres, as I said, Tuesday, September 25th, here on WJCT Television. We're pleased right now to learn more about this project as we welcome Ken Burns to Studio 5 to discuss the film and take your calls. Such a pleasure to have you on the show. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's 549-2937 to connect with Ken Burns right now as we discuss the Mayo Clinic, Faith, Hope, and Science. We're also streaming this live on video, live on our WJCT Facebook page. You can watch the discussion there. Send your emails, too, to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or just comment on Facebook, where you can also watch the live stream. You know, it's just such a pleasure to talk with you about this. I've, like so many other Americans, I've been a longtime fan of your work and your incredibly prolific output. So many amazing films that tell us the story of America in so many ways. Why pick Mayo for your next project? What drew you to this story?
People often ask, you know, how I pick the topics, and the sort of glib flip answer is that I don't pick them, they pick me. And I think what unites all of the projects that we've tackled is a sense that they represent utterly, quintessentially American things, people, events, institutions. And so in many ways, I make the same film over and over again. And each film asks a deceptively simple question. Who are we? Who are these complicated people who like to call themselves Americans? And what does an investigation of that particular story, but our past in general, tell us not only where we've been, but where we are and where we may be going? Mm-hmm. The simple, direct, honest answer is that it's just a wonderful story that I think could have only happened here, but it's also a universal human story about what we owe each other in terms of taking care of each other, about how the greatest hospital on earth got created, who the people were, all the interesting ingredients, all the things they do well. And while our film is not, involved, it's a history, it's not involved with the current healthcare debate, you can't help when it's over to sit back and look and say, well, these people seem to have gotten it right in so many ways. What could we do to rescue the healthcare conversation from the politicians who've kidnapped it and made it a binary, you're wrong, I'm right, kind of argument over the last several decades, and go, well, these people have been doing it for almost 150 years, right? And they're doing it in these sorts of ways. There may be something in it for us. And I hope that maybe, besides telling a good story that people will be blown away by, that you'll also, maybe it'll permit us to have the kind of conversation we never quite had about what it is we should do with this big, huge, giant 800-pound gorilla of healthcare.
Healthcare. If you want to talk about healthcare or anything, really, with Ken Burns, the acclaimed documentary filmmaker, he's in studio right now. Give us a call at 549-2937. And yes, you know, as you pointed out, in Rochester, Minnesota, they were able to figure out a way to put patients first, deliver world-class care, and it was a group of people who really didn't have a whole lot in common in the beginning. This right. country doctor, Dr. Mayo, who was not a man of faith, and these Sisters of St. Francis combined their talents to make this thing work.
It's so improbable. You just can't make this up, right? I mean, you have this tornado. The sisters get involved. They're trying to help Dr. Mayo and his two young sons, Will and Charlie, who have not yet gone to medical school but who are assisting in operations and office work. And they'll eventually become the Mayo brothers, which will change exponentially what this small family practice is going to do. And the nuns say, well, you know, Mother Alva said, we'll build it. And they did build it. And so all of a sudden they're working together. And what happens is that they both brought to the table values and this idea that the patient comes first. That kind of seems obvious to us, particularly mm-hmm. all of us who will, all of us be patients, or at least initially, we're caring very deeply about someone that we love who's a patient. And yet, in the real world, it's the doctor who, operating alone, is the godlike figure. And if it's not the doctor in a modern equation, it's the hospital administrator leaning over his shoulder or her shoulder, mm-hmm. or it's the insurance company. They put the patient first. The patient is still first, and it is the miracles that have happened from that very simple equation and all the other stuff that they've done over the last 150 years have rippled out. And so just a mm-hmm. few weeks ago, the U.S. News and World Report ranked Mayo once again as the greatest hospital in the United States, which means in the world. And we ought to be saying, how did this happen and what can we do?
Sure. How can we replicate those results? And of course, we're lucky here in Jacksonville to have the Mayo Clinic. It is part of our just outstanding medical care we have in this area. We're known for medical tourism, in fact, not just with Mayo, but also with UF Health's Proton Therapy Institute. We have the new MD Anderson Cancer Center opening here. So there's a lot of great healthcare here. But, you know, whenever I talk to people that work at Mayo Clinic here in Florida, the center of the universe is still in Rochester, Minnesota. The mothership is up there, of course. And as I was watching a preview of your film, one thing that kind of struck me as someone who grew up in the Midwest, is that Midwestern values are really at the heart of this health system. It's this sort of humble, can-do, teamwork attitude.
That's exactly right. Lots of stuff happened. Not only were you going to put the patient first, not only were you going to import the values of the Franciscan sisters and bring to your own sense of commitment to other people that Mayo had and imparted to his sons, but you're going to eventually say, boy, we're making a lot of money. Let's go nonprofit. Let's put it back into the service that Dr. Will, one of the sons, said that suffering humanity had paid to them. It was too much money. And so they're nonprofit in a trend in healthcare towards profit. They also said, let's put everybody on salary so that you're not being rewarded for ordering unnecessary tests. And what that did, in addition to make sense, it gave you time. You weren't a doctor who said, boy, if I don't see eight patients in an hour, I can't pay my overhead. So you go to Mayo, and I've been a patient there, and you're having an annual checkup, and the doctor's talking you to an hour and a half, and you're saying, boy, don't you have to be someplace all the time in the world? And if there's a question outside of his specialty, he'll call someone up who's immediately available to answer that question. So you're just, it's an efficient machine that also hasn't lost sight of its values. And what that being on salary did is it selected for people who were interested in collaborating. And so all of a sudden, you're a patient and you're in the hospital room and you don't have your doctor who finally has a couple of seconds to stop by and see you. You've got 10 doctors who are surrounding you, and you're suddenly realizing, yeah, I am drawing on the best that the Mayo Clinic has to offer. And a lot of that came from the Midwestern ethic of humility and humbleness and the values that the Franciscan sisters also insisted.
Yeah, that really stuck with me as I watched it, as someone who grew up in that part of the country. So I'm so glad that you see that too. And I also read that you spent 3 years, I guess, spending a lot of time in Minnesota researching this project, years with the folks at Mayo Clinic.
This film is co-directed by myself and Eric Ewers, a longtime editor of mine, and his brother Chris, who's an extraordinary cinematographer. I think they made 60 plus trips. I didn't make as many with our producer, Julie Kaufman. And sometimes it was observing surgeries that are just stunning. Sometimes it was meeting new patients. Sometimes it's delving into the archives. Sometimes it's just ranging out into that Midwestern landscape and sort of filming, this secular temple, as one of our commentators says, that grew up out of the Midwest and made everybody in the Midwest very, very proud. And of course, as you said, destination medicine is a huge part of what the attraction is to the Mayo because of these values. And you meet the people who work there, and they've got something. This humility, but this sort of striving towards excellence, and the story itself, how it happens. I mean, our narrative is sort of complex. It's the arc of the history of the Mayo Clinic, but it's interspersed with contemporary case studies, and a few people are well known, like the Dalai Lama or John McCain or Tom Brokaw. But most of the people that you meet are the doctors and the nurses trying to figure out what's wrong, and the patients who have exhausted all other possibilities elsewhere and who've arrived at the Mayo Clinic, perhaps having seen 40 different specialists, being told perhaps that they should get their affairs in order, they're going to die. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, the Mayo intervenes and says, no, you have this, or yes, this is a pernicious disease, but we think we're going to try upend the protocol and do it this way. And the latter person's in remission, and this woman who had spent years trying to get a diagnosis suddenly had one in 20 minutes and suddenly could be plowing towards treatment. And so, science is at the heart of it. These people are fanatical about learning the latest thing and sharing whatever they learn with the rest of the world without fear of proprietary stuff, which is, of course, what we all do today. But it's also about faith and hope, which is why those are the other two words of our subtitle.
Let's go to some calls now for legendary filmmaker Ken Burns. His new project is called The Mayo Clinic, Faith, Hope, Science. It will premiere later this month on WJCT television, but now's your chance to talk to Ken live in the studio. Let's begin with Terry in Fernandina Beach. Hey, Terry, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was curious. I didn't know that Mr. Burns' films were so directed, I guess, really to a business. It seems odd that it was focused on Mayo. I mean, I've been a patient at Mayo, and I understand their model, but would it be more interesting to have included some other historically great hospitals or medical providers as well? I mean, I can't wait to see the film, but I just have this feeling it seems like an infomercial for Mayo.
Well, you know, in public television, we don't make infomercials, and this is not a Valentine.
It's a story,
The Mayo Clinic, and we certainly show some problems. You know, we've done baseball, which you could argue is about Major League Baseball, a corporation, but we're looking at the enduring values that sort of come out of the Mayo story and the arc of it. We didn't need to do a compare and contrast. This was the story of W.W. Mayo, his two sons, Will and Charlie, the practice they created in association with a small order of nuns in Rochester, Minnesota, a small town founded at the edge of the frontier in the 1800s and has grown to be the best hospital on earth. It's in itself just a wonderful, wonderful story. But our filmmaking, as we do in public television, is not uncritical. And there was no thumb on the scale from Mayo Clinic as we made it. They gave us total access to our great, great delight, having to sort of swallow hard and realize that if we did discover things that needed work, and we did, they would be willing to accept that. So we would have it no other way.
You're always just attracted to the power of the story.
That's exactly
it,
right.
Sounds,
you know, I'm all my films are in American history, but the word history is mostly made up of the word story, and mm-hmm. that's a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. I read in something that the novelist Richard Powers, he said, "The best arguments in the world won't change a single mind. The only thing that can do that is a good story." So I've spent my life, a lot of documentary are about essays, about trying to convince you, perhaps politically or otherwise, about something. We're not interested in that. We don't have our thumb on the scale in terms of politics. We're interested in, say, with the Vietnam War or with the Mayo Clinic, saying, here's a good story. Here's some complicated people and characters involved. And we'd love you to see it, because we think that in the reception of the story, as it was for us, we hope our viewers will see that all the free electrons that are given off by the collision of events and individuals ask a lot of questions, and questions not about the past, but also about the present. You know, I don't think that history repeats itself. I don't think we're condemned to repeat what we don't remember. I subscribe to what Mark Twain is supposed to have said. He said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
Yeah.
And so I think when we finish a film, we're always so amazed at the rhymes in the mm-hmm. present moment, whether it's the Vietnam War, whether it's the Civil War. And I think the same thing is true of the Mayo Clinic. When we finish, we lift it up and we said, wow, this is dealing with some stuff we're dealing with now.
Is this your contribution to the really contentious divide in America over how we deliver healthcare to American citizens?
No, but I do know that it can, now that we're done, now that we were disciplined enough not to do that, which gets you stuck into these binary arguments of yes and no, red state, blue state, you can begin to step back and say, well, what's happened? You know, for the last 30 years, this healthcare conversation has been hijacked by politicians. Let's take it back and say, well, look, here's evidence of one way to do it. There's nonprofit, they're on salary, there's collaboration specific, the patient is first, the records travel with them, all the ingredients, which Mayo this is not a secret recipe. They're willing to share with everybody, and it ought to be incumbent upon us, as we're arguing over single payer, which was what Hillary and Ira Magaziner wanted in the 90s, and then the Heritage Foundation suggested, a conservative suggested this. Mitt Romney adopted that for Massachusetts. Barack Obama, who believed in single payer, said, well, I want to reach out to everybody, so I'll take Mitt Romney's plan, which was the Republican plan. And because he was for it, then Republicans were against it. So you got kind of go, well, what happened to my question about what do we owe each other in terms of care? Or do we owe anybody? Well, just let them die, right? Is that how we wish to be? And of course not. No one wants that. So then let's try to figure out what works. Well, this film, not intended to be part of the debate, happens to be a good story, I think. I hope the audience will agree or disagree with that. But it's about a place that works.
Lots of tweets and emails for Ken Burns. Lisa tweets the show, a profile is a perfectly legit form of journalism and is distinct from an infomercial. Mayo Clinic, PBS sounds like an important story for our time. Courtney tweets us, unfortunately, in the big business society we live in, the patient does not come first. It's all about the money. This from a nurse that's been working in the system for the last 13 years. Thanks for that, Courtney. Catherine emails us, Ken is a national treasure. Thank him for all of his outstanding work. I have learned so much and in an entertaining way. It's true. I'm always amazed at how you can take still photos, very little moving video from the time periods you work in, and create such compelling film. And you know, we can continue to talk about that too, but let's get a few more calls in for you. Lots of folks waiting to connect with Ken Burns. Mark is in Mandarin. Hi, Mark.
Hi. First of all, thank you for your documentaries. They're wonderful. You mentioned that the Mayo Hospital in Rochester is ranked the best, and I've heard that before. Do you happen to know what the rankings are, if any, of the other Mayo hospitals like the one here in Jacksonville? And were the sisters who were so instrumental on the founding the Mayo Hospital in Rochester, were they involved in the other Mayos like the one in Jacksonville?
You know, that's a wonderful question. I believe that the ranking is for Rochester, but I'm not exactly sure. I think it could include the whole Mayo system, the two satellite campuses that they have in here in Jacksonville, but also in Scottsdale, Arizona, which we visited, and we have case studies represented in the film from both of those. I think when you go to Mayo Clinic today, then the sisters are still a huge force. And I was surprised 8 years ago when I made my first visit there attended a lunch that this was not some part of some distant past mythology in the 19th century, but very much a part of the present ethic of Mayo. And I think as the sisters age out, there's a kind of anxiety there that how do we keep their values present. And they do have committees and advisory boards that are interested in that. And I do believe, though clearly North Florida and the Phoenix area are different in culture than the Midwestern nice that Melissa and I were talking about a second ago, that they have insisted that these values travel. And that
they do. By the way, here's one small example of that. I just want to jump in and say that I know several female employees at the Mayo Clinic. And only a few years ago did they do away with a rule here in Florida that traveled all the way down from Minnesota that they had to wear pantyhose every day of the year, including in August in Florida, and no pants. They have to wear a dress. Men have to wear a suit and tie. They finally threw that out here in Florida a few years ago, and there was much rejoicing.
You know, there is a sense, though, that because of the involvements in the nuns, this must be some quaint and antiquated sort of romantic version of how medicine. They've always been on the cutting edge. They've always been the ones to learn more and to teach more, and to the collaborative nature of it always means that you never assume that you know everything, and that doctor doesn't have that God complex that we see too often in our television shows about medicine, that there's something really great. We begin the film with an African proverb that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And that I think this is a lesson also for the United States. Our Latin motto is E Pluribus Unum. And it's very clear, as the historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr., the late historian, said, there's too much pluribus and not enough unum today. And I think in some ways, all of the films I've made have been about unum, how we can take these events, these individuals, these institutions, whatever the subject of our films may be, and find out how we might put our oars in the water, regardless of red state or blue state or politics or age or wealth or sex or whatever it is, the distinctions that we superimpose on people, put our oars in the water and pull in the same direction. They're doing that at Mayo. What could we bring from that?
And jam lines about this project for Ken Burns right now. Let's get a few more of you on the air. Jill is in Fruit Cove. Hey, Jill. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to switch gears a little bit. I have seen the Finding Your Roots when Ken was featured, and wanted to know, I know there was a surprise about some of his ancestry in Civil War time. I was just curious if there was anything else you learned that maybe didn't make it into the edits the rest of us have seen on your time with Finding Your Roots.
You know, that's a really great question. I presumed, being an American and having relatives from both sides, that there would be people who owned slaves. And it turned out I had one slave owner, modest, you know, one or two slaves. I was not shocked by that. You know, that's been, people have often wanted to cover up that part of it. The thing that bothered me more is a little bit farther. On my mother's side, there was a Tory during the American Revolution. A guy named Eldad Tupper. And that really bothered me. I end up doing deep dives in American history. And every film that I make, with the exception of one or two, when you do that deep dive, you're going to bump into race. You know, we struggling with it here in Jacksonville. It's been part of our legacy of slavery in a country dedicated to human rights. It's always there. So I'm unafraid of confronting that. And it's there in the Mayo Clinic film as well. I was thrilled, by the way, to learn and have finally proven, after many other genealogical sources had not, that something my grandmother had told me when I was a little boy, she was a scientist, so I didn't think she'd make something up, that she felt that we were related somehow to the poet Robert Burns. My father was Robert Burns. His father was Robert Burns. And though we'd come to the United States, our branch, before Robert Burns was born in Scotland, Skip Gates and his mitochondrial DNA search did do a couple of hits of a cousin and an aunt of Robert Burns. So suddenly our family's mythology became important.
The talent runs in the family.
Well, that's very nice of you to say. But it was a lifelong pursuit, and every other genealogical search had resulted in a dead end.
It must have been interesting for you to have the tables turned. Instead of you doing all the research, you were the subject of
research. It was very emotional for me, too, because I learned that I was the fourth cousin of Abraham Lincoln, that I was related to the Tafts and the Roosevelts and the Bushes and to the current Prince Philip, that there was
a complete six degrees of separation.
It was stunning. Yeah. And to have, both North and South. I mean, I have spent my entire professional life, more than 40 years, struggling to come to terms with us. And the fact that I contained, as Walt Whitman said, the multitudes of us, Southern as well as Northern, Eastern as well as Western, people who were doctors, people who were soldiers, people who were slave owners, people who were trying to liberate slaves, that all of that meant that this thing in me that drives me towards telling these complicated American stories, that I contained all of that in my own story.
Jay tweets the show as we speak now live with Ken Burns. He tweets, Vietnam was amazing. After watching it, I rewatched Full Metal Jacket and had a whole new appreciation. Still blown away. Kathy tweets us, excited to attend the preview tonight at UNF. Maybe I'll spot my husband's grandmother in one of the photos. She was a nurse and worked with the Mayo brothers. It's family lore we're proud of. So that's kind of cool.
Oh, great. Yeah. We got the Mayos have been really good about keeping the archives. And so there's some footage, very early footage from the operating theaters, lots of still photographs. And so I hope that you'll find your relative there.
Ella on the South Side. Hi, Ella. You're on with Ken Burns. Go ahead.
Hi, Ken. I just want to say I'm a huge fan.
Thank you.
The Dust Bowl was probably my favorite. And I know you've done work with David McCullough before, and I was just wondering if you might be doing anything else with him, possibly on the Revolutionary War.
Well, it's funny that you asked, Ella. Thank you so much. I love the Dust Bowl. You know, it was very interesting. We were interviewing people in the late 80s and 90s, and I suddenly had this revelation in the editing room that we weren't talking to people in their 80s and 90s. We were talking to children and teenagers, that suddenly by asking them questions about this time when their parents were anxious, obviously all of the parents are dead, that they accessed this incredibly traumatic moment when not only was this man-made ecological disaster destroying their crops and their cattle, but also their children. And, you know, suddenly these men in their late 80s were breaking down and crying over a little sister who passed away, not even 2 years old, way back in the early 1930s. And it was as if it was happening yesterday. And there's something incredibly poignant. And I feel so privileged to be able to do that. The thing about David McCullough is he narrated most of the first six films and was the senior creative consultant on the Civil War and narrated that series. He appeared in our Roosevelt series, an interview. And we are, I'm very happy to report, beginning a biography of Benjamin Franklin that will take a few years to do.
Oh,
and
really?
Our next war, if that's the correct way to do it, after doing the Civil War in the 90s and World War II in the aughts and Vietnam in the teens, in the 20s, in time for the 250th anniversary of us, both little U.S. and big U.S., we're doing the American Revolution. And I hope that David McCullough will have a moment to talk about what he knows about the American Revolution.
So a film on Benjamin Franklin and a film on the American Revolution.
Among many, many others
that
we have going.
What else is in the pipeline?
So we have we just finished a big series on the history of country music that will be out a year from now. We're opening our editing room on a three-part, six-hour film on the life of Ernest Hemingway. We're just filming right now a lot of interviews and doing archival research on a biography of Muhammad Ali. We're doing a history of the buffalo, that is to say, how an animal that is so kind of a symbol of us, again, little us and big us, gets down to a handful of breeding pairs and then is brought back from the brink of extinction. De-extinction is a big word right now, very important, and we just want to tell the story of this animal, which is, of course, meaning the story of lots of interesting human beings. We're doing a history of LBJ and civil rights. While we're doing Vietnam, one of the most tragic aspects, almost Shakespearean aspects, was Lyndon Johnson and his failures in foreign policy, which jeopardized his ambitious domestic agenda. And so we want to sort of go back and have put the gun of Vietnam off stage. You can hear them getting louder and louder, but to understand the kind of that. So look.
You're not busy at all.
We're scheduled out to 2030, God and funding willing. But I can tell you that if I'm 65, I'm busier than I ever been. And I think it has to do with greed. I just am greedy for new stories and greedy for that creative moment of waking up and trying to make a film better. And I think.
Do you feel time speeding up as you get older and feel this imperative to you? I mean, you're still so at the top of your game. I relate to this. What I sense with you is you feel this need to really make the most of your time, do the best possible work.
I hope so. I mean, I felt that from the beginning, and the anxiety in the very beginning was really profound about how do I take this film on the Brooklyn Bridge or the Statue of Liberty or the Shakers or Civil War and do it right. And I think that we're a little bit relaxed and beginning to trust to the process. And I work with extraordinary people. I sit here, you know, the beneficiary of so many nice accolades and kind comments online and over the air. But really, I'm a conductor of an orchestra of really talented writers and co-producers and co-directors and editors and cinematographers. So that I just sort of feel like if I'm making continually the distinction about us and U.S., I ought to say that is not an I, but a we. And you know, we try it. If I were given 1,000 years to live, I wouldn't run out of projects in American history. I don't have 1,000 years to live. So there is a sort of increasing urgency to try to do as many things. But also what we're trying to do through, we started a foundation called the Better Angel Society, and people raise money for us. But we're also looking to do enhanced education stuff and try to train a kind of next generation of filmmakers that will sort of carry on this sort of, we're not interested in propaganda films. We want to tell stories that everybody can sink their teeth
in.
We don't want to preach to the choir. We want to reach out and make new converts to American history.
AJ writes on our Facebook page, I love Ken Burns' work. Before he got into documentaries, wondering what he did, he would have made an excellent educator. I see you as an educator. You just started reaching a huge audience.
We had 52 million people who watched the Vietnam series, 39 the first time the Civil War was broadcast, 44 when baseball came out. I mean, this is, I work in public broadcasting. I love it. I've had offers to go someplace else, but the creative freedom and more importantly, the creative independence is there in public broadcasting. And so, I am one teacher in a network that is the largest classroom on earth.
One of your projects I truly loved was your project on our national parks, America's Best Idea, yep. as it was called. And I have to tell this story just because it's a fun story. There's a much-loved writer and columnist here in Jacksonville named Mark Woods, and he wrote a book called Lassoing the Sun, A Year in America's National Parks. Well, as he was getting ready to publish the book, I said, Mark, you simply have to get a hold of Ken Burns and get him to write a blurb for the cover of your book. And Mark said, oh, he'll never do that. I can never get a hold of him. I said, yes, we can get a hold of him. I know just who to call. So I called the lady that runs the Arthur Vining Davis Foundation here in Jacksonville, which helps produce your wonderful films. And she got through to you, and you sent in the quote for Mark's book, Lassoing the Sun. And as I heard the story, they got the quote from you literally as it was going to print. And somebody was literally running down Fifth Avenue and walking into some publishing house at the last minute saying, don't print it yet. And so he got that blurb from you, which I was as excited as if it had been my book. It was just the greatest thing in the world. So
that's a good story.
I'm really glad that you could, in a small way, could lend your name to that project as a way of furthering the national parks beauty and importance.
Well, it is so interesting. It's not Wallace Stegner, the writer, was the one who said America's Best Idea, and we used it as the subtitle. As someone in the opening moments of the film corrects, it's not the best idea. The best idea is the articulation of universal human rights, and we set a government in motion in 1789 that would try to reflect those values. We've done a good job and we've done a bad job. And that's the stuff of the stories we tell. But once you'd created that country that was struggling to live up to its creed, you'd be hard pressed to find a better idea than the national parks. We like to say it was the Declaration of Independence applied to the landscape. For the first time in human history, land was set aside not for kings or noblemen or the very wealthy, but for everybody and for all time. And in this magnificent state, if you think about the Everglades and what that could have been, a series mm-hmm. of strip malls drained of its water, a series of golf courses, of housing developments, and it represents one of the most diverse, if not the most diverse in term habitats on Earth, where the only place where crocodiles and alligators coexist, and all of these birds and incredibly delicate flowers like bromeliads. And if you've ever been in the Everglades, and just the idea that it could have just disappeared, and yet we saved it. And all the story of the national parks are the story of people in an area saying, this is too beautiful. Let's just save it for our children's children's children, as TR said.
That's right. Let's take one more call for Ken Burns. It's Mark in Ponte Vedra Beach. Hey, Mark, good morning. Go ahead.
I cannot believe I'm talking to the famous Mr. Burns. I'll be at the program also tonight, and yes, ditto to you being a national treasure, sir. Couple quick items. A lot of people don't realize that many of the Mayo doctors have a background in scouting and are, in fact, Eagle Scouts. They don't make a big deal about it, but it's one of those things that I'm sure in your research you found out that they're a big supporter of scouting throughout their different campuses.
You know, if you go into the Mayo Clinic with the idea that, I went into medicine, I'm going to make millions, you know, the Mayo Clinic is not for you. If your initial impulse and continuing impulse is service, then you're going to do really well at the Mayo Clinic because it is that collaborative teamwork. And I am not surprised and have not been surprised to see that so many of the physicians and surgeons and others were involved in scouting, because that's exactly the values that scouting at its best teaches. And so this is not a surprising statistic. You tend to find that in people in the military. You tend to find that in other leadership positions. When you have somebody who's a true leader, who's building consensus, who's trying not to make the other side wrong, but to listen to the values that they have, that's willing to learn and be corrigible, that is interested in collaboration and teamwork, you've got a person that's going to fit perfectly into the Mayo Clinic scheme. It's a person that is going to fit perfectly into scouting, obviously, in any way. And I think what's so interesting that we've discovered is that the Mayo Clinic's message applies across the board. We're struggling for leadership. We look to our past. We see in Abraham Lincoln and others these great models of leadership, and we wonder where they are. Well, they're all around us, and I think there's a hunger and a starvation for real leadership that puts not my own political advancement above the fact that I'm there to serve the people who voted for me. I'm also there to serve the people who didn't vote for me.
Wouldn't it be nice if more people thought that way? Well, you know, this is such a pleasure. And for everyone that's been listening and interacting with us, this is just a short preview of what is going to be happening tonight on the UNF campus, where there will be an advanced screening of Ken's new film, The Mayo Clinic, Faith, Hope, Science. You can also catch the official television premiere Tuesday, September 25th. On WJCT television, and just go to wjct.org/events for more about tonight's appearance on the UNF campus with Ken Burns. Such a pleasure, and thank you so much for being with us here on the radio. Really exciting to have you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Melissa.
We will be right back.
Hi, I'm David Luckin, host of the Elector Lounge. Did you notice we're trying something new? An uninterrupted fall pledge drive. You're listening to it right now. A quick interruption, but not of the programming. We're just covering up a promo. Our goal is just $60,000, and we know with your help today, we can keep this fall drive radio uninterrupted. Please take the time now to call 353-9528 or go online now with your financial support to wjct.org. And thank you so much for your support.
Hi, this is Keith Marks. Join me every Thursday evening at 11 p.m. for Avant Radio, a show of curious music for curious minds. Each show is themed, curated, and contextualized to explore new music. Come get curious on Thursdays at 11 on 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. Well, as Hurricane Florence bears down on the Carolinas right now, here in Florida, of course, we are crossing our fingers, hoping to be spared from a terrible storm this season. Not only that, it turns out hurricanes are inspiring art here in Jacksonville. There's actually a show coming up tomorrow night at the Kummer Museum of Art and Gardens. A composer who wrote an album between Hurricanes Matthew and Irma. Hurricanes inspiring music. Let's talk about it with co-producer Corey Driscoll and, songwriter Corey Driscoll and co-producer Aaron Garvey. Hi, guys.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Hi, Melissa.
And just pull that mic close to you, Aaron. Okay, Corey, let's start with you. What is this project all about?
Well, so when Hurricane Matthew hit, I lost power for about 5 or 6 days and was alone in my house with an acoustic guitar and not much else to do. So I started composing this record, and that's how it began. I was writing about storms, maybe sort of more of an interpersonal storm, you know, familial type storm. And then when Hurricane Irma came 11 months later, it seemed like a very good time to say, we'll call that done now.
Yeah.
We've got to finish before the power comes back on for Irma. So, that's kind of how it got started. And then since then, Aaron Garvey of Long Road Projects and Keith Marks of Avant kind of helped me put together this one-time experience at the Kummer Museum tomorrow.
This should be an interesting experience, Aaron. Is it my understanding that meteorologist Mike Burrish is going to give a talk before the performance about hurricanes?
Yes, that is correct. So he will be discussing climate change, global warming, the effects on Florida as a whole, and the First Coast.
So not only is this artistic, this is going to really educate people about what we're experiencing in terms of a warming planet. That's pretty cool.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit more about the music itself.
So the music is it's a personal narrative, sort of really arranged to feel as though a storm comes to disrupt a family vacation. There's sort of, it starts off very positive, something comes to disrupt it, and by the end we're powers out and it's an acoustic performance and there's more of a rally cry to the people.
We need that, don't we? Especially after last year. Gosh, I mean, I love the idea of taking something that can cause so much devastation and creating something beautiful and artistic.
Yeah, that's definitely the goal. Tropical Depression is the name of the show, and it's sort of about that, I think, in a nutshell.
How can people be part of this? Free, or do they need to get their tickets?
It is a ticketed event. Tickets are $15. They can be found on 904TICS /Tropical Depression. Mm-hmm. It's Friday night. Doors will open at 7 p.m. at the Kummer Museum. And we also have a limited edition vinyl record.
Nice.
That we have produced. It's an edition of 70. And that's the front and back, both sides of the album.
Tropical Depression. Catch it tomorrow night at the Kummer Museum of Art and Gardens. Luckily, Hurricane Florence is nowhere near us, but you can vicariously remember the chaos of it all if you go to 904tix.com. Get your tickets now. This is tomorrow at the Kummer Museum. Corey Driscoll, Aaron Garvey, what a unique and cool project. Thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us, Melissa.
And finally, this hour, some exciting news. The Jacksonville Film Festival is back after a several-year hiatus, announcing their 2018 official slate. We're going to experience a variety of films this weekend, and it begins with a red carpet event Friday night. We are pleased to welcome Nikki Logorecki, I hope I pronounced that right,
yes,
and Tim Driscoll, both with the Film Festival. And by the way, Tim is Corey Driscoll's brother. We've got one brother here talking about his event at the Kummer, another brother talking about his involvement with the Film Festival. You must have some very proud parents, Driscoll brothers.
I don't want to speak for them, but I hope so.
Okay, let's begin with you, Nikki. You're the festival director. It's really exciting to see this festival return to town. How did it come back after being away for a while?
Yes, good morning, by the way. So I was a volunteer when I was really, really young for the film festival. And when I was like 16, 17, and at that time, because I was young, I had to have my dad take me there and kind of hang out with me because you couldn't have a young person volunteer at that age. But it was the most amazing thing ever for me because I was a student filmmaker at that time and I wanted to make short films. And being part of the film festival was kind of like a magical thing. And then a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, I kind of found out that the film festival was kind of dormant. So I tried to contact whoever I could and find out what was going on. And then about a year and a half ago, me and some friends, we just kind of contacted. So one of the people that we found out was one of the board members was Michael Boylan, which is the former president of WJCT. Mm-hmm. So, and he's been extremely helpful. He's an amazing person. And we just kind of start talking to him, start talking to Todd Rubin, which is the film and TV film commissioner in Jacksonville. And we just kind of build a business plan and an idea. And then from then we just kind of...
And here you are.
Yes.
Okay, Tim Driscoll, tell us about the films. What can people come out and see?
We have some great stuff. It's the way it works out, but we are also Friday and Saturday night. So if you're into music, by all means, you need to go show up to the Kummer and get your tickets before those sell out. But if movies is your scene, which is, you know, it's sort of how we are, my brother and I, movies is my jam. So Friday, if you're able to make it out, we have a block of documentaries. which are absolutely beautiful. They're beautiful stories. That block's about an hour long. Two of those films are actually local films. One is from I'm not sure if it's a former or current DA student. And then we have the world premiere of a movie called Rehabilitation of the Hill, which is a feature-length film about the Hill District in Pittsburgh. And though that's about Pittsburgh, I think the subject matter is very poignant to what we deal with here in Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. The movie takes two sides of the gentrification line.
That is relevant.
Yes. It's about a young woman in a nonprofit trying to rehabilitate the homes that are there, people who have lived there most of their lives. That's their community, and they want to hold on to that. And the other side is a group of people trying to basically clear out space and put in high rises for urban development. Mm-hmm. So I think the movie is fantastic. It has a documentary vibe to it, which is why it sort of fits with our our documentary block. Demetrius Wren, the director, was flying in from Los Angeles, so he'll be here to introduce the film and then do a Q&A afterwards. And then Saturday we have just a full slate of a bunch of fun things. We're starting off at 4:15. There's a feature film called The Dirty Kind, which is a hard-boiled feature film. Then we have another break for mingling and beer and wine and a red carpet aspect. Then we go into two short blocks. The first short block, we call it Home and Abroad. We have a number of films from the United Kingdom plus some local stuff that we'll be screening together. Those films are beautiful. They're warm. They're heartfelt. They're giant hugs. We have a 15-minute break, and then we get real dark. So our last block has some fantastic films.
You look excited
films.
About that.
Horror films is not really my genre per se, but I do love that block. We call it Utterly Macabre because it is the darker aspect of film and film stories. But in that block, we have things that screen at the National Film Festival, South by Southwest, Toronto,
wow,
Sundance.
Wow, very cool.
Yeah, so you don't take my word for it that they're good. Other giant festivals have said these are great films. Yeah.
And all of the films, by the way, screening, is this right, at the Hicks Auditorium at the Main Library?
Yes, I'm glad you said that because I sometimes forget where I'm going to be.
Okay, so visit JacksonvilleFilmFestival.com because the big event is this weekend downtown at the Main Library. Click on the website, get your passes for Friday and Saturday, including that red carpet event. And kudos to you both, Tim Driscoll, Nikki Logorecci. Going to be a great weekend for cult art and culture in the city. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's
a
pleasure.
Fun.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs our board during the hour. Our show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. This is 89.9. We'll be back again at 9 a.m. tomorrow with our Friday Media Roundtable. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.